Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Today, my colleague and co-host Sam Wong can't join us. It's conventional to hear about discussions of the state of conservatism in different moments. I remember after the Bush administration ended, there were many panels. I was on some of them on the state of conservatism. Is there a crisis in conservatism and what the future is? This is an ongoing conversation that we've had certainly in American politics since the 1970s when the conservative movement really took hold and reshaped American politics with President Ronald Reagan being the first person in office who in some ways brought together the different strands of the movement and introduced them at a national level. Today, there are debates again on the state of conservatism in the era of President Trump, the president who on the one hand has benefited from some of the work of the movement in terms of strengthening the Republican Party, has also challenged many arguments that the right has made over the years, including on issues such as trade and internationalism. So what is the state of conservatism in 2018? And where are these ideas? Where is the movement, if there is one? Where is it all going? And our guest today is Arthur Brooks, who's the president of the American Enterprise Institute, which has been one of the most influential conservative public policy think tanks in recent decades in Washington, D.C. Arthur Brooks is also the author of numerous books, including The Conservative Heart, How to Build a Fairer, Happier, and More Prosperous America with Broadside Books. And he also writes columns in many outlets, including The New York Times. So, Arthur, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Julian. Great to be with you.
So I'll start with the question that I brought up in the introduction. What do you see as the state of conservatism in 2018?
Yeah, you know, I hear that question a lot because as president of AEI, people, we're known, we've been around for a long time, we're an 80-year-old think tank, and a lot of people on the left know our work because we're broadly understood to be an academic institution with intellectual freedom, kind of the center-right equivalent of the Brookings Institution on the center-left. And that's, in fact, our most frequent collaborative partner, and they're two doors down from us on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington. So we have a lot of exposure to people on the left, and they ask me this and ask our scholars this a lot, you know, what's going on with the conservative movement? One of the things that I like to bring up is that the conservative movement has never been a very cohesive philosophy in the United States. It's always been something really in flux. So people, you're in my age, we think of Reaganism as the quintessential American kind of conservatism, but that was a very weird innovation, actually. It influenced a couple of generations of people who consider themselves to be American conservatives, including me. I mean, Ronald Reagan was elected when I was in high school. I couldn't vote for him the first time, but I came from a very liberal background. I grew up in an academic family in Seattle, Washington. So, you know, my mother was an artist. My father was a math professor. You guess how they voted, you know, and in Seattle, which is redundant to say that it's liberal. But when I listened to Ronald Reagan, and it kind of had an effect on me, I felt that he loved me. I know it's crazy, and people are kind of rolling their eyes as they listen to this, but it's worth pointing out that there was a real feeling of in solidarity of somebody who really wanted to bring the country together. My parents never liked him. But, you know, I was attracted to it. It took a number of years before I accommodated myself to a lot of, you know, the details of what that was. I was working as a musician all the way through my 20s. And so I didn't even know anyone who had voted for Reagan. But it was something that kind of lodged in me. And the result was that's what I thought of conservatism for the longest time. In many ways, Donald Trump harkens back more to a traditional conservatism that's more associated with what the movement would be, sort of Taftism. You know, the idea that the Republican Party has traditionally not been a free trade party. That was since about 1980. Ronald Reagan was the first president really to open up free trade to make things cheap in the world and to globalize the world. But before that, Republicans were traditionally associated with more closed economies, fewer immigrants, less trade. And that was that's the more mainstream philosophy. And that comes from the tradition of conservatism in Europe, which has a lot more sort of altar and throne, blood and soil involved in it. So it's worth pointing out that this isn't so weird. It's just kind of a return to the way that things were before you and I were paying attention to politics.
And so for you, when you think back to Reagan's conservatism, maybe that's the exception, the period that followed. What does that mean to you in terms of core ideas or principles beyond him? What was it about?
I think that what Reagan brought was something that was, I think that in the mainstream, let me back up, in the mainstream in American political thought, by that I don't mean academics and intellectuals, people like you and me. I mean, you're actually a historian, and which so I say all these things with appropriate humility. I'm just an economist. But I think that the mainstream of political thought in just Americans who are going about their daily lives without, you know, trying to form a coherent political philosophy, I think everybody's a progressive. Almost everybody's a progressive in the United States. We're just different kinds of progressives. Why? Because this is a nation that's built by ambitious riffraff. I mean, the Zelzers and the Brookses were the riffraffiest of the riffraffy. I mean, I'm just going to guess you didn't come from landed gentry. It's like they were poor and they came to the United States because they were running away from the blood and soil. Traditions of other places that made them outsiders. That's a beautiful thing about this country. It's really, I'm very proud to live in a country that was built by outsiders. And so under those circumstances, we bridle against the idea of entrenched social class. We don't like it. We don't like the altar and throne of other countries, you know, bowing down before authorities that say you're born important and you're not. Because if that were the case in the United States, there would have been no reason for your family or mine to come here in the first place. That's also one of the reasons that under ordinary circumstances, people from all political tribes love immigrants in the United States. It's just that these weird paroxysms that come when economic growth is not shared widely and people feel threatened and people are afraid that they will tend to turn against outsiders. So my view is that conservatives in the United States really should be called progressive conservatives. They believe that traditionally American conservative ideas, at least since Reagan, free enterprise, American leadership in the world, even traditional family values are the best way for people to make progress. You go to mainland Europe, continental Europe, and they're not talking about progress. They're talking about preserving institutions and preserving the old ways. I don't know that many people in the United States that really care that much about the old ways, including conservatives. Do you agree with me?
I'm going to stick with you. I'm curious where you are more than where I am. And I do agree with you just in terms of the diversity of ideas that are often clustered into movements. So it's helpful to hear you disentangle some of that. But, I mean, your path into conservatism was through academia and primarily, am I correct, through economics? I mean, was that the major influence in terms of how you became associated with conservatism?
Sort of. I mean, really the biggest influence on me that really made me into a conservative, believe it or not, was the music of Bach.
Okay.
I was a classical musician for a long time. I didn't go to college until my late 20s. I made my living as a classical musician all the way through my 20s. And my favorite composer was Bach. And this quote of Bach's had a big impact on me. He was arguably the greatest composer ever lived, 1685 to 1750. Unbelievably productive, an innovator in the high Baroque, and then the greatest teacher of his time. And he said, when he was asked, why do you write music? He said, the aim and final end of all music is nothing less than the glorification of God and the refreshment of the soul. And man, that rocked my world because I thought, can I say that about my work? I want to say that about my work. And so I went in search of something that I thought would lift people up. And believe it, it's the weirdest thing. I know it's going to blow your mind, Julian. I became an economist because of Bach. Bach pushed me out of music and pushed me into economics. So I was looking for something where I could do more good. I was very interested in poverty. I was very interested in why people could be lifted out of poverty.
And when I found the 1990s or 80s?
Yeah, this is the 1990s.
Okay.
1990s. And I had had a series of experiences traveling as a musician, State Department tours and things in the 1980s where I saw really extreme poverty. But also, I was a little kid in the 70s and I saw pictures of the Ethiopian famine, and it was the same sort of desperation and sense of impotence that a lot of Americans had. And I wondered, what has happened to you know, impoverished people. Well, I went to college when I was starting, when I was 28 years old, and I took this economics class, and I learned that 80% of the world's poverty had been eradicated. Starvation level poverty had been eradicated since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that, it seemed to me, and this seemed beyond politics, left, right, and center, people seemed to agree that there are these forces that did that. It was globalization and free trade and the spread of property rights and rule of law. And it was the spread of the culture of entrepreneurship, largely an American culture of entrepreneurship, spreading around the world as people saw it around the world. And they sort of threw off the chains of tyranny and poverty, and it saved 2 billion lives. I couldn't believe it. Now, just believing in those things kind of made you into a progressive conservative. So I backed into it on the basis of caring an awful lot about poverty and trying to follow Bach's maxim about how to have the life dedicated to the most people.
And were there parts, so this is in the 90s. So one thing that I'm thinking of is obviously this is when we have a debate over welfare here in the U.S. culminating in 96 in the welfare reform.
Yeah.
But it's also just a big era for conservatism with the Gingrich revolution in Congress and the shift that takes place, even though you have a Democrat in the White House. Were there parts of conservatism then in the 90s, not back, looking back at the Taft era, that you didn't like, that you weren't comfortable with? What were those?
Yeah, the part of conservatism I've never liked is the same thing that I don't like about liberalism, which is the pugilistic wing. The idea that Americans who disagree with you are your enemies. That is crazy. I mean, this is the freest society in history. And the idea that somebody who disagrees with you is somehow worse than ISIS is a big problem. It's a metastatic problem in American politics. And I think in the 90s, it was really taking off because these kind of political proxy culture wars were I mean, they've always been around. I mean, as you're the historians, you're going to be like, hey, dude, look at the 19th century. And I got it. I mean, it was Franklin Pierce was a terrible grifter and, you know, all of these guys. But in recent times, the 90s were a kind of a bellicose period where we tended to attribute historically murderous ideologies to our political foes. And that was very uncomfortable with it then. And I hate it even more now.
And why do you think that happened?
That happens because we tend to be very relative in the environment. In our own environment, we look around and people that we disagree with, even though there's no knock in the night, there's no jackbooted thug or totalitarian government, anybody who disagrees with us must always be the adversary. And if you want to gain power, you get that power by ginning up a whole lot of paranoia and anger toward the adversary. That's extremely irresponsible behavior, and it's bad leadership. And it's bad leadership on the left, and it's bad leadership on the right.
And then you published a book, I think it was one of your first books, Who Really Cares?
Yeah.
About compassionate conservatism. And that came out in 2006 or 2005.
I'm impressed. 2006, yeah.
2006, I remember. Yeah. So now we've moved forward to the, this is when President George W. Bush is in office. What was your take on compassionate conservatism, which was one of his key principles, obviously, in 2000 at least?
Yeah. So I wrote my main area of academic research, I was teaching at Maxwell School at Syracuse University at the time, and I'm an economist. So I was doing what economists always do. I was running a lot of regressions showing, you know, how different economic forces would impact my key area of research, which in my case was charitable giving. I'm super interested in charitable giving because I'm a behavioral social scientist. And that's a weird area. Why do people give away money for no apparent reason without getting any evident gain from it except warm glow and a sense of citizenship? And why do Americans do it where almost nobody else in the world systematically does it? It's a really weird phenomenon. So I was studying that, and one of the questions that I had was, who really gives? I mean, a lot of people think they do, but who's actually doing the giving? How do they break down a religion? How do they break down an ideology? How do they break down on age? How do they break down on income? And I found a whole bunch of things that were not very controversial, but I thought pretty interesting. So, for example, as a percentage of income, the working poor give the most, a lot more than the rich as a percentage of their income. I thought that was super interesting, like 4x. It's really quite something. And they get no tax deduction because they don't itemize their deductions on it. So, but the part of the book that got all the attention was that I showed that conservatives give a lot more than liberals do to charity. And the main reason is that conservatives tend to be more religious. Religion is really the big swinger behind that. It's just that there aren't that many religious liberals left in America. There are some. I mean, of course, there are millions. But there are four times as many religious conservatives as religious liberals. And that's what was driving the thing. And I was kind of matter of fact about it. And the subtitle put on the book by my publisher, it was my first commercial book, so I was pretty green, was The Surprising Truth About Compassionate Conservatism. And I thought, oh, I've never been associated with politics. I'm actually not that interested in politics per se. I'm more interested in kind of the climate science of ideas as opposed to the weather of politics. I'm a better climate scientist than weatherman. And then it got picked up. And so the president said something about the book. It was a very boring book, by the way. It's a mathematical appendix. It was like all of my books. And nobody had ever read any of my books. And the president says something about it, gets a bunch of press. And my book is, you know how this happens, Julian. An academic suddenly is selling hundreds of copies a day. Mm-hmm. It was, my life changed overnight and permanently. As a scholar, it was crazy. And I'm getting an email from people I've never met before. You know, I love your book. I hate your book. One guy writes me this letter, "Dear Professor Brooks, you are a right-wing fraud." And, you know, I remember distinctly because it was a weird interaction. And that was a new experience for me, I have to say, because that was when I became kind of a more publicly associated with a conservative ideology than I had ever been before, because I didn't consider myself to be publicly much of anything.
And then Chris, you've continued with this theme, and you've written more. Your 2015 book was also about a new conservative agenda and focusing on issues like poverty. Critics will obviously say that the conservative movement, at least as expressed in the Republican Party, hasn't focused as much on those issues, and the economic policies have been skewed to supply side economics and often benefiting the wealthy. How do you, especially in your position, how do you respond to that fundamental criticism of the discrepancy between those on the right who say they want to tackle poverty and the kind of tax and economic policies that often come out of Republican politics?
Yeah, no, I hear that a lot. And the main criticism I get today is that, you know, you're big into, you know, compassion and love and brotherhood and solidarity and all that, but Trump, right? And yeah, I mean, I don't win. I'm not a politician. I just have ideas. I wish that everybody in America were following my ideas. That'd be awesome. Actually, that might not be awesome. Who knows? I mean, you know, if everybody were doing what you and I as college professors suggested, it might be pretty dangerous. As a matter of fact, that would be a dystopian hellscape, you know, America run by college professors. But it is true that, you know, a lot of my ideas are not always translated into public policies. Now, that said, about a lot of the supply side stuff, I understand that some of those experiments have tended to have consequences that have not had as much benefit as people thought they were going to have with respect to trickling down to poor people. But at the same time, one of the things, the key points that I try to make in my writing is that one of the mistakes that we've made in poverty policy, left, right, and center, especially left, however, is that we've tended to look, especially since the mid-1960s, at poor people like liabilities to manage in our society. We've gone from needing them. I mean, the Zelizers and the Brookses came here because America needed poor people to build this country, not for exploitation, but because we just needed to make the country. And that's what opportunity was all about. And we've gone from needing people at the margins of society to helping them. Look, I want to help. That's everything from my basic ethics to my religious views are about helping people. But what all of us need in order to sense our dignity is not to be helped, but to be needed. And so the most misguided part of public policy that I think that as regards the people at the periphery has been to tell them every day in every way, you're superfluous, you're not needed, you're a liability, as opposed to you're an asset, you're needed. Assets are very expensive to develop. It's hard to make people needed. But that's the reason that we need to do things why economic growth and opportunity are so critically important, that we need policies that have great education for skills and training, why we actually should have policies that require work for welfare, because that's a need-based policy. Does it always work? Nuh-uh. Is it something that's going to be successful in every experiment? Even less. But I think that's the philosophy behind a lot of this stuff that I would like my liberal friends to appreciate a little bit more.
And then how did you become the head of AEI? How does that happen?
I became head of AEI because they had a failed search for president in over the course of 2008. And that's not just self-deprecating. What happened was...
And you were you at Maxwell?
Yeah, then? I was an academic at Maxwell. I'd never had done any management, literally never had one employee. And what happened was that they'd had a worldwide or mostly a nationwide search for a new president after the long-term successful presidency of a guy named Chris DeMuth, who was a phenomenal president, but he was retiring. And I mean, 22 years is a long time. And they were looking and looking and looking. And after 14 months, they were out of time and out of ideas. And, you know, somebody came up with the idea, this Brooks guy at Maxwell. I was a visiting scholar at AEI. Mm-hmm. I don't know, let's talk to him. I don't know. And you know, one thing led to another, and they wound up offering me the job. But it was with great trepidation all around. I mean, the first order, my board is hard-driving, you know, hedge fund managers and private equity guys. And the first order of business in my first board meeting was to discuss the terms of my severance, because there was so little confidence that it was going to go well. I mean, frankly, you know, we're searching for a new president right now because I'm stepping down next summer, and it's going much better than it did last time. But thank God for a broken search, because I wouldn't have had the opportunity otherwise.
And well, so you're in this position from 2008, 2009 through today, and you're stepping down. What's the role of AEI in the current political climate, which you've written about? What does a think tank do? I don't think many people even know.
So a think tank is effectively a university without students. There are a lot of different models. A lot of think tanks, there's 750 think tanks in America today, which is basically, there are too many. I mean, there's a glut in the industry. There's an oversupply. Easy for me to say, because we're one of the five biggest think tanks in the world. But what a think tank does is effectively, at its best, should not have corporate policies, should have academic freedom, and should model the idea of a competition of ideas internally. Now, most think tanks have mission principles that are a little bit different than Princeton University. Princeton University is what, improving America and the world or something. I can't remember what the mission statement is. But basically, the functional mission statement is to create a great education, to create a new generation of well-educated leaders. And so the teaching function is really paramount. And the research function behind it is not going to have an overt ideological bent. Think tanks usually do have a view on the world. Our two mission principles at AEI are, I mean, we have two philosophical pillars, which is the radical equality of human dignity and the limitlessness of human potential. As a policy matter, what our scholars really agree on is that the American free enterprise system is imperfect, but it's pulled more people out of poverty and create more opportunity than any other system in history, and that American leadership is of great benefit to the world. Everything beyond that is open to contention. Everything beyond that is a competition of ideas, and our scholars disagree on everything. If I've got five scholars, I have 50 opinions. And that's as it should be. It's as it should be at Princeton, and it's certainly as it is. There's a huge amount of academic freedom. There's no corporate line. I don't spike anything. I read nothing anybody writes before it's published. And so that's what a think tank is doing, is really creating an idea agenda for policymakers, for members of the business community, for the general public on TV and events and books and articles. And it's just the idea engine that's supposed to fuel the competition of ideas that creates American excellence in public policy. That's our goal.
And what does it mean to create an agenda for policymakers? So in a university, you're just kind of writing and doing your thing. But think tanks are more particular, and they have an audience in mind. What does that mean in practice for someone like AEI?
So policymakers, they need actual ideas. So the key mistake that a lot of think tanks make is getting into the weather of politics. Politicians are the weathermen. Pundits are the weathermen. We don't do that. You should say the climate science of ideas is supposed to be above that. You know, creating ideas that are really good, notwithstanding the political conditions, recognizing that sometimes you're going to be famous and sometimes you're not. Sometimes you're going to be relevant and sometimes you aren't. There are political conditions in which it's actually most appropriate to be creating good ideas that are not currently relevant. And that's the kind of courage that you have to have when you're running an ID institution like AEI, which I've been completely committed to in the last 10 years since I've been president. It's making sure that our relevance comes entirely from the relevance that we can have as an idea-generating institution that creates productive concepts that'll be useful to politicians, not trying to help anybody with political prospects or political gain. So what that means effectively is that we take the highest standards of research and exposition, and we translate that into actionable policy ideas, not writing legislation ever, because that's not what we do, but big ideas that we can work with leadership on both sides, not to mention state and local policy, which we do more and more and more of, and politicians and policymakers and regulators and diplomats and the military, they can take this stuff and use the ideas. The surge in Iraq is a classic case of this. In 2006, when the United States was clearly losing the Iraq war, the concept of surging in Iraq was opposed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And AEI scholars, a guy named Fred Kagan, who runs something that we call our Critical Threats Project, came up with this concept of the surge in Iraq and proposed it kind of over the objections of the Joint Chiefs, and Vice President Cheney and President Bush. They said, let's take a shot. This think tank, we trust these guys. They're good, smart guys. They're kind of call balls and strikes. They're more or less fair brokers. And it really helped a lot in that conflict. It's still a super controversial conflict. I got it. You know, and a lot of people listening are like, terrible, terrible idea. But once we were in it, something had to happen. And that turned out to be something that was quite successful and constructive. And that came right out of a think tank, AEI.
And how does all think tanks, right and left at this point, I've been in some of them, face a challenge, two challenges, it seems. One is the relationship between the ideas that the scholars produce and the funding that comes in. And there's often criticism that those get aligned one way or another. It's hard to disentangle. And the second is just the current atmosphere where there's so much disinformation, false information, and idea chaos in some ways in the public square, that it's hard for a think tank to, you know, do what it did 20 or 30 years ago, have the same kind of stature. How have you at AEI dealt with both of those challenges?
It's tricky for sure, because, you know, in the era where everything you don't like is called fake news, that means that research and ideas that don't align with your political proclivities are funded by some reclusive, secretive billionaire that you don't like, and simply trying to put money in the pocket or to goose the political process in a way that you're worried about or that you hate. And so we face that all the time. But the point is that you have to remain true to your ethics and standards and simply try to dominate on the basis of productivity and excellence. Not to mention the fact that never getting down into the mud is critical. I mean, I'm talking to the scholars all the time about making sure you're not wrestling, that you're staying above a lot of these fights. And even if people are unfair to you, excellence will pay off. Sometimes it feels counterproductive, the whole debate, and sometimes it feels like it doesn't work in our favor. But I actually think it does. You know, when I hear people on the left all the time who say, "Oh, AEI, we really respect you guys." There are people on the right all the time who say, "Oh, the Brookings Institution, those guys are fair brokers." It is one of the reasons that Brookings and AEI are considered to be these two think tanks that do excellent academic quality work. That's not affected by political money. The other thing is that you have to have standards in place to make sure that's not the case. We take no government money from any government, any place, anytime. We don't do any contract work, which means you can't pay us to do any project. And we make sure that there's a complete firewall between any corporate money that we take and the research that we do, so that when we get corporate contributions, like 10% of what we get, that they have to be for general contributions. So you're not going to be paying for, you know, you're not going to get somebody who pays for a particular line of research that could any way be associated with the findings, not to mention the fact that nobody gets to review the research before it's actually published. So we have firewalls in place to ensure against that. Now, that said, people are always going to be suspicious. That's just the way that the whole thing works. Oh, AEI, you guys are just in the pockets of right-wing billionaires. Brookings, you guys are just in the pockets of George Soros or something. It's nonsense. You got to put up with it, because these are the charges that are always flying around.
And how? So here you are, you've been at the head of this very prominent conservative think tank, and you're watching the Trump presidency. You've also written about the need, as you said on the show, to not vilify the opposition and to have a more civil debate. How have you watched this presidency unfold? And what do you think its impact is going to be on on the kinds of ideas that you have stood for and for the Republican Party? What will it mean to have Donald Trump in the presidency as a Republican?
We don't know is the key thing. I mean, if I knew that, then I would be a great political prognosticator, which probably mean that I would be a good investor, in which case I would have a hedge fund as opposed to being a college professor. We don't know what's going to happen. But if history is any precedent, president comes and goes. The political movement comes and goes. But the people at the helm of the idea business, they tend to endure a lot more. One of the things that I really am encouraged about, I mean, I can't stand the environment. It drives me crazy of vilification on both the right and the left. Populism is a very dangerous business. And ethno-nationalist populism is an especially dangerous business because it's out of the American equilibrium. I mean, ethno-nationalist populism would have driven your family and my family from coming to the United States in the first case. And that would have made a less successful country, and it would have been a less American environment as we understand it in its best sense. So I don't like it to begin with, but I think it's a huge opportunity. There's been a lot of stuff going on over the past few decades, and particularly over the past 10 years, where despair around the country has been largely ignored from all different parts of the population, as a matter of fact. And when we in a populist environment, populism basically gives voice to despair, and it does so generally pretty unproductively, but it rips the scab off something, and it gives guys like you and me and people listening to us the opportunity to have conversations that we wouldn't have had because they wouldn't have felt relevant. And so it's time for us to say, what are we going to do in the current environment? I believe that, you know, I've looked at data. There's a great organization called More in Common, run by an Australian guy named Tim Dixon, who does a lot of polling in the United States. And what they find is that 93% of Americans hate the current political environment. What that effectively means is that 7% of Americans are driving the bus of hatred and contempt in American politics. I have a new book coming out called Love Your Enemies. It's coming out in March. And this book talks about what actually we can do to use the current environment to create the America that we really want, that to use it as the launch pad for the cultural entrepreneurship that should be the basis of American renewal that we wouldn't have been able to do had it not been for this discomfort. So, you know, I'm more hopeful than I've been in a long time, paradoxically, because I can't stand the current environment so much.
And one last question that I was thinking of, two of the movements that have had a pretty significant impact in recent years. One is the Me Too movement, and the second is the Black Lives Matter movement. And they're usually obviously associated in terms of where the movement has the most support with Democrats and liberals. For a place like AI, are they trying to tackle some of the issues that the movements have raised, and how?
So these are the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement. These are movements about dignity to a very large extent. And that's an incredibly positive thing. Well, somebody that I've worked with a little bit and that I've written about and who certainly features prominently in my next book is a guy named Hawk Newsom, who's the president of Black Lives Matter of Greater New York. I've had him at AEI. I've had him on my podcast. And he's incredibly compelling about helping people understand the dignity issues that are at play. In America today, people are all worried about populism, identity politics on the right and left, the paroxysms on campus, deplatforming, shutting down points of view. I'm against all of that big time. I'm against deplatforming anybody in the right or left. I hate what's going on in a lot of small liberal arts college campuses, where even with violence, they're shutting down different points of view. But you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, the idea that there are people in America that have systematically suffered from having their groups have their sense of identity systematically lowered, that's a big problem. And again, when you have an environment like the current one, where there's a lot of attention put on this, that's a big opportunity for all of us. It's an especially big opportunity for those of us that are not in the political movements that are most associated with these groups to learn to treat people with greater dignity. And so when these movements change, which they naturally will because everything changes, we don't go back to a status quo that attenuates people's sense of their own dignity. This should be a big moment of opportunity for all of us.
How can we get a place where conservatives and liberals, not politicians, but certainly intellectuals, but maybe politicians as well, can have spaces where there are actual conversations and where there can be efforts. You know, the ideas are often very different about what has to happen. But how can you, I mean, you've been in a unique position. How can you facilitate conversations between the different sides that are ongoing, that aren't a one-time conference?
I think all of us have the opportunity to do that. And one of the reasons I'm leaving AEI and I'm going back to academia, I'm going to go back and teach at university starting next summer, is because I want to dedicate myself to the social movement of doing that, of bringing America together. I don't think that there is a huge policy agenda for doing that. I think it's a social movement for doing that. I mean, it's funny, inside organizations, inside communities, and certainly inside families, you can create a culture where love is cool, where learning from other people is good, where treating people with respect is, or not treating people with respect is actually stigmatized. You can do that, but you actually that is based on a moral social movement, not based on policy. It's not based on a bunch of regressions. And I'm dedicating myself to a social movement of bringing people together when I go back to academia, as a matter of fact. So a couple of things to keep in mind, however, there's some things like this, and they tend to be misguided in a couple of ways. The first is that they're looking for areas of agreement, and the second is that they're trying to push people towards civility. And both of those things are a little bit misguided. Agreement should never be the standard. Disagreement is the basis of the competition of ideas, and competition brings excellence. The lack of competition brings stagnation and mediocrity. We know that in politics, we know that in economics, we know that in sports, and that is certainly the case in a culture and economy that's being driven by ideas. We need lots and lots and lots of disagreement. We don't need to agree more. We need to disagree better. The second is civility, which I hear all the time. We just need to be civil to each other. That's an absolute garbage standard. You know, it's like if Julian, if I said, you know, my wife and I are civil to each other, you'd be like, whoa, man, you guys got to get some counseling. You know, that's the wrong standard for America. That's the wrong standard for Democrats and Republicans, for conservatives and liberals. We need a much higher standard than that, which is acceptance through respect, and which is actually a kind of love. And that's the reason my current book is called Love Your Enemies. It's actually the only thing wrong with that title is that the people who disagree with you shouldn't even be your enemies in the first place. And so I'm working toward social movements that we can build along these that try to build along these principles. And so, you know, to all the listeners, pray for me.
Well, thanks again. We'll end on that note. Our guest was Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, who will be stepping down and starting a social movement for civility and returning to academia, the author of numerous books, including The Conservative Heart, and soon to come in March, Love Your Enemies. So thanks again for joining the show.
Thanks, Julian. I appreciate your show a lot.
And once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.